You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, watching Schrödinger's cat die in quantum experiments.
And so, in fact, you can actually watch the Schrödinger cat eventually start to die or to come back alive or anything in between. And so you can think about that as suggestive of a new kind of active quantum control.
How black holes turning into white holes could solve an information paradox.
The actual black holes we see in the sky are sort of bouncing stars seeing in extreme slow motion.
Sharpening Occam's razor using category theory.
Yes, I'm trying to work, why does Occam's razor work or seem to work? And I'm also trying to somehow quantify Occam's razor.
And linking quantum pigeons with a new kind of spooky correlation that goes beyond entanglement.
And there are fundamental new aspects to the whole question of what is an interaction and what is a correlation.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
Thank you for tuning into the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. With this edition, we're trying something new.
That's right. Just for this podcast, my cat Puffy has stepped in as guest editor and has chosen the items to be featured. So we may have more emphasis than usual on feline-related news, including quantum cats and pigeons. So, Puffy, do you want to introduce the first topic?
Okay, Brendan, can you translate that?
Sure, that's Puffy explaining that the first item is based on a new experiment that was published in Nature in July, which is related to the paradox of Schrödinger's cat. You know, where you shut a cat in a box with some poison that may or may not be released depending on whether some quantum event occurs. So Puffy's basically saying no one would ever dare try that with him.
Right, okay. Well, we should add that it's just a thought experiment. So, if this quantum event occurs, let's say if a radioactive atom in the box decays, then the poison is released and the cat...
Puffy, stay calm.
Then the poison is released and the cat dies. If the radioactive atom does not decay, then the cat lives. But the quantum catch is that, according to quantum mechanics, until you open the box, the radioactive atom exists in what is known as a superposition. It's both decayed and not decayed at the same time.
Which suggests the cat is both alive and dead. The standard story goes that it's only when you open the box that the radioactive atom collapses into one state, which in turn determines the cat's fate, happy or sad. But in a new experiment, physicists have shown that you can actually track the cat's fate while it is in the box, potentially even allowing you to steer the outcome.
Of course, they've not done this experiment with cats, but rather with superconducting quantum circuits that, like Schrödinger's cat, can exist as a superposition of two mutually distinct states, in this case, in two different energy levels. I spoke with one of the theoretical physicists behind the experiment, Andrew Jordan of Rochester University, New York. He explained how special kinds of measurements could be used to track the transitions between quantum states, and how this technique may one day be used to control quantum systems.
And so this was a collaboration between my group at the University of Rochester doing the theory, and Irfan Siddiqui's group at the University of California at Berkeley doing the experiments. And the experiment concerns a particular kind of quantum system. It's a superconducting quantum system. So that means a little bit like your Schrödinger cat, it's actually a fairly big object. It's not like an atom or a molecule or something like that. So the experiment is quite an important experiment, I think, because it shows really for the first time the ability to do these continuous measurements on a single quantum system while it's actually trying to move around. All right. So what they do is they have this quantum superconducting qubit. They give it a name. They call it a transmon. And the way they measure it is they put it in a microwave box. So this is like the microwave oven you have at home. You warm up your food in, but it's a little bit smaller, but not that much smaller. It's on a table. And, of course, this is all done at low temperature. But what they do is they're able to send in microwave signals, and these microwaves interact with this essentially charged degree of freedom in this superconducting element. And the light comes back out of the experiment, and then they're able, by looking at some properties of that light, they're looking at some phase shift that they're able to amplify, they can then essentially infer what's going on with this quantum coherent system.
The big question there is that, you know, whenever we talk about these quantum systems, we're always told that, you know, as soon as you look at them, as soon as you measure them, you know, you completely sort of destroy the quantumness and they just, you know, the cat collapses, it becomes either dead or alive. So, you know, you're talking about something where you're kind of monitoring something that's happening. So how are you able to carry out measurements without destroying the thing that you're trying to measure?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. So it turns out this picture of, which we learn in sort of textbook quantum mechanics, you measure it and then it projects it, it's either alive or dead, it's in one eigenstate or the other. This is only one kind of limit of a whole different range of measurement options people have. And these experiments are some of the first to really look at basically saying, we don't have to do that all at once, collapse it into alive or dead, we can continuously monitor what's going on with the quantum state. And as we do that, we can have a theory that describes how the quantum state is changing a subject to that looking at it. And so, in fact, you can actually watch the Schrodinger cat eventually start to die or to come back alive or anything in between. It's now a continuous process.
And is it fair to say that, you know, if you do these kind of very delicate, very subtle measurements where you're trying to get a little bit of information about what the system is like, you know, rather than a very dramatic measurement, which would just kind of collapse the system into dead or into alive in one go, that there's some kind of trade-off so that perhaps you're not disturbing the system as much as you would with one of those brutal measurements, but maybe you're not getting back as kind of accurate information, or maybe the information is a little bit more uncertain.
Yes, so what you're saying is correct. You don't get perfect information about what the state is, but you get somehow hints, you get partial information.
What sort of results did you walk away with from this experiment? What did you learn by doing this that you didn't know beforehand?
We said, suppose you prepare the quantum state in some initial quantum state, and then imagine we measure for some time t that you give me, and then I want to imagine ending up in some final quantum state that you can also choose. And the question we are interested in is, we said, what's the most likely way the system changes so it can go from A to B in some time t? And the way I formulated that is similar to many other things that occur in physics that have a similar kind of flavor to them. So one example is Fermat's principle of least time. And that's the statement in classical optics that says, if I have a source of light and I have a receiver of light, what path does the light take to go between source and receiver? And the answer is that it optimizes some quantity, which is the time between these two points. And so what we formulated now is, we formulated a kind of quantum version of that. We kind of have a quantum principle of least action. And so what the Siddiqui team was able to do is they were able to check that theory. They were able to run many, many realizations of this experiment as the system was changing. So in addition to being able to monitor the system continuously, they were also able to drive it continuously. So the system was always trying to turn, for example, from the ground state to the excited state and the excited state to the ground state while it was being monitored. And this is a completely new experimental achievement on their part. And what they found in this Nature article is that you have very beautiful agreement between their data and our theoretical analysis.
You sort of described how the team have really done something quite new and different in the way that they're able to kind of monitor and also, in some sense, steer the system that they were looking at. Is that something that will have applications down the line, either in, I don't know, quantum computing or perhaps in terms of looking at chemical reactions?
So one element of quantum technology that's active now is this field of quantum control, being able to push quantum systems where you want them to go and when you want them to go do that. And so one of the interesting things that our theory predicts, not only does it predict the most likely quantum trajectory that does that, but it also predicts the most likely detector output. So how does the detector respond in its most likely way that accomplishes that particular task that goes from quantum state A to quantum state B in some time? And so you can think about that as suggestive of a new kind of active quantum control. So you can imagine trying to engineer your environment or your detector to be able to respond in such a way such that it pushes the state on average where you want it to go. So that is, I would say, is the most immediate sort of application or next step anyway of this research.
That was Andrew Jordan talking with Zia. Now, from steering the reactions so that you get the products you want to steering the future. As many of you know, this year's FQXI essay contest asked, what steps should humanity take to make the world a better place? Well, the judges have made their decision, and earlier this month, we awarded first prize of $10,000 to Sabine Hassenfelder for her essay, How to Save the World. Congratulations, Sabine.
Yes, well done, Sabine. You can read her entry, those of the runners-up, and all other submissions on the website, www.fqxi.org/community. And if you check out the blog, you can also watch a Google Hangout in which Sabine and the two second-place prize winners, Daniel Dewey and Jens Niemeyer, discuss their ideas.
Thanks to the essay contest, we can rest easy about the fate of the world. But what about the fate of other cosmic objects, like, say, a black hole? What would happen, for instance, if my cat Puffy was on a space expedition and got sucked into a black hole?
It's a terrible thought, Brendan. Conventional wisdom tells us that Puffy, or any other matter or light that fell into a black hole, would be trapped there. This, in fact, led to a paradox. In the 1970s, Stephen Hawking calculated that black holes slowly emit radiation, eventually shrinking down and disappearing altogether. The question was, what happens to the information about the matter that fell inside?
Oh, Puffy. It's actually a profound question because the laws of quantum mechanics say that information cannot vanish from the universe. So where does it go?
Well, FQXI member Carlo Rovelli of Aix-Marseille University has been thinking about that question, along with his colleague Hal Haggard, and they've come up with an answer. They've been investigating a model called loop quantum gravity that Rovelli and others developed, which says that space-time itself is made of loops that serve as indivisible atoms of space-time. As a result, their analysis shows that black holes could eventually turn into white holes, spewing out everything that they once ate, as Rovelli explains.
A black hole is a sphere where things can fall in but not come out. And a white hole is a time reversed of that. So it's a sphere where things cannot fall in, they can only come out. Nowadays, black holes are conventional objects, so the estimate is that there are millions of them just in our galaxy. And our hypothesis is that the white hole, like black holes, they do correspond to something real in the universe.
So we've sort of got this idea of black holes that swallow everything that falls into their sort of event horizon. And, you know, they swallow matter and they swallow light. And then you've got white holes, which are kind of the opposite of that and let all that out again.
Exactly. Our work started from a question. We know that the black holes that we see were formed mostly by collapsing stars. So the star collapses and it falls in and goes inside this horizon, this sphere where nothing comes out. And the question we ask is, where does it go, all this matter? So let's follow it. And the theory, which is classical general relativity, tells us that everything which falls into the black hole goes more and more to the center because it's attracted by the center. Then the theory breaks down somehow. The Einstein equations don't tell us what happened. And good, because we know that the Einstein theory is incomplete because it doesn't take quantum mechanics into account. So obviously what happens at the very center of the black hole is something that cannot be figured out just by using Einstein theory. We need also quantum mechanics.
Now we're talking about your particular study and the program that you've been investigating, this kind of loop quantum gravity.
Yes, the applications of loop quantum gravity in similar situations indicate that there is a huge force which is repulsive at very, very small scale. So matter doesn't just go to the very, very center. It at some point gets to maximal compression, and then there is this quantum pressure, and matter bounces out. what's going to happen next is pretty obvious. Every time something similar happens, imagine you have a ball, you let it fall to the ground, it gets to the ground, and there is a pressure that pushes it up. What happened next? Well, it bounces up. So the collapsing matter might very well bounce. If it bounces, what does it produce? Well, of course, a white hole.
Let me ask you a bit more about loop quantum gravity, because, you know, it doesn't have to particularly be loop quantum gravity that we're thinking about. We're thinking about sort of a quantum effect. But
yes,
just to sort of clarify, in loop quantum gravity, we're talking about there being some kind of limit to how much you can compress space. Maybe you can explain that more and explain how this effect might arise out of loop quantum gravity specifically.
Yes. Loop quantum gravity is the idea that space is like matter, has a sort of atomic structure. And one of the consequences is that matter cannot be too compressed.
You know, we've sort of set this up now to explain how we could get the reverse of a black hole and we'd have a white hole with, you know, matter coming back out. But what would that look like?
Exactly what you said. So the same thing that goes in would come out.
So it wouldn't be mashed up or mixed up in any way. It would be, you know, exactly what went in comes back out again.
We have a simple model in which we have just the bounds and what comes out is exactly what went in.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, reality is always more dirty than our simple models, right? A ball doesn't bounce up exactly the way it fell in because it leaves some heat on the ground, because it gets compressed a little bit, it gets distorted. So I imagine that in two real astrophysical situations, things are not going to be really symmetric and perfectly like in our model.
Should we be looking for stars suddenly popping up?
Absolutely.
You know, is this something that astronomers could look for? Or what kind of evidence could they look for?
Absolutely. This is why we are all excited, because if the story is true, we should see these things coming out. And we have begun to study the possibility of seeing a signals of that. But before getting into that, let me add one element to the story, which is probably the most beautiful element of all.
Mm.
Suppose we have a star, right? We see a star collapsing, and there's a supernova, for instance, and we see that these things produce black holes. And in fact, we think that the majority of the black holes we see in the sky are produced in this way. So the star collapses, goes inside, and of course, the process of collapse is very fast, is extremely fast. The time it takes to get to the quantum compression is very small. It's order of milliseconds or even microseconds. And then it bounces out, and just a microsecond. So why don't we see immediately the star bouncing out? And that's the beauty of the story, because in general relativity, we know that time does not go at the same speed everywhere, meaning that processes go slower down in gravity when you're closer to the center of the star, when the gravity is stronger. Now, inside a black hole, gravity is so strong that this phenomenon is huge. So the time dilation is immense. So what would we see? We see a star collapsing and then bouncing up, but we see a sort of a slow motion from the outside, incredibly slow motion. So what we see as a black hole, the actual black holes we see in the sky are, if this theory is correct, are sort of bouncing stars seeing in extreme slow motion. And the question we ask is that how are we going to see these explosions if we can see them at all? And the answer is that if it explodes now, what we're going to see is some cosmic rays.
Cosmic rays are very high energy particles that astronomers have picked up. And they're obviously very interested in investigating why they have such high energies.
And the hope is that among these cosmic rays, we could identify those produced by black holes that have ended the bounce and are coming out. So this is a concrete prediction and hope that we have, and this is what we are working on.
Let me ask you about another piece of work. A few months ago, I did another podcast interview with someone I'm sure you're familiar with, Jorge Pullin.
Yes.
And he and his colleague had carried out a similar sort of analysis to you. He's also looking into loop quantum gravity, and he was interested in precisely this question. Using the sort of approximations and the analysis that he did, he came out with a slightly different answer. Rather than a black hole turning into a white hole, you'd get kind of a tunnel or sort of a wormhole into another part of the universe, and that's where information would escape. You know, what do you think of that paper, and how does it kind of sit with your paper?
He was not looking for directly a collapsing star. So he was starting from a slightly different perspective. But my hope is that we should converge, because the main hypothesis behind, which is loop quantum gravity and the discreteness of space-time, are the same. So I would view this as just work in progress, and stay tuned and let's see what happens.
This work also addresses one big paradox, or one big question that people have been thinking about for decades now, where they've been thinking about what happens to information that falls into a black hole.
Yes.
Because, you know, one thing that people realized a few decades ago, thanks to Stephen Hawking, was that black holes can radiate energy and sort of shrink and shrink and shrink until eventually they'll disappear.
Exactly.
And there was a big question about what happened to the information inside that. How important was that question to you specifically, that sort of decades-long paradox, when you were thinking about this particular model?
Very important. In fact, that was one of the paths that we got to this model. This model, if it is correct, is a complete solution, of course, to the question, because information that falls in just comes out. It's like, you know, take a book, you close it in a box, and then you look at the information, but then when you open the box, it's there. So information is conserved. However, I think the interest of this series is not just that it solves the information paradox. The interest is that it might be an actual process in the universe that we could see and we could check directly, if we were able to see some result of some exploding black holes. So for me, this is not just a way for solving the information paradox. This is a way for answering the question, where does matter go when it goes to the center of the black hole, and a way to possibly hope to see experimentally, observationally, an effect of quantum gravity.
That was Carlo Rovelli there chatting with Zia.
On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we have links to Rovelli's archive paper, articles about loop quantum gravity, and our podcast interview with Jorge Pullin about black hole singularities.
So the real question is, while looking for evidence of white holes, will astronomers be paying particular attention to the Cat's Eye Nebula?
Brendan, is this your attempt to justify why this item was of interest to your cat, Puffy? Well, I'd like to see how you connect cats to our next interview.
Well, that's easy. It deals with the branch of mathematics known as category theory. That's category theory.
I'm not even going to dignify that with a groan. But tell me more.
Nosin Yanofsky of Brooklyn College, New York, has been using category theory to investigate a principle at the heart of science, Occam's razor. That's the rule of thumb, first articulated by a medieval monk, that says that if you have competing explanations, which could account for the same observations, you should favor the simplest, least elaborate theory. But is there any reason to trust this principle? Is it just a matter of intuition? Or can we find some sort of solid mathematical basis for it? Reporter Sophie Hebden met with Yanofsky to find out how he is tackling this medieval maxim that still puzzles scientists today, and the reactions to his latest popular science book.
William of Ockham was born in southern England in the 14th century, and amongst his religious writings, which angered the Pope enough to get him excommunicated, forcing him to live in exile, was a maxim relating to science that we know as Occam's razor. It states that given a choice of different theories to fit a phenomenon, you should choose the simplest theory that works. But why should the universe work like this? No one has shown why the principle should or shouldn't work. I met Nosin Yanofsky in a coffee lounge at Churchill College, Cambridge last month to find out how he's tackling this deep philosophical question. A question that has eluded mathematical analysis for centuries.
So Occam's razor says, you know, if you have a complicated thing to explain something and you have a simple thing explaining something, cut away the complicated thing and keep the simple thing.
Mm.
Okay. Now, most people say Occam's razor works in the universe. Somehow the universe can be described as somehow simple. I don't know if it works. It's a philosophical question.
So are you trying to, like, so ask why that is?
I'm trying to work. Why does Occam's razor work or seem to work? And I'm also trying to somehow quantify Occam's razor. And by measuring the structures, mathematical structures, I'm trying to say, you know, how complicated is something? And why does it work? So that's an interesting question. Why does Occam's razor work? And does it work? Maybe it doesn't. Maybe the world is a little bit more complicated than it is simple.
To find out how simple or complicated a scientific theory is, Yanofsky is working out how to quantify its information content. A complicated theory will contain more information, a simple theory less information. But scientific theories have such varied mathematical structures, how can they be compared? This is where Yanofsky's background in a branch of mathematics called category theory comes into play.
So I work in an area called category theory. And category theory is a language that was started in mathematics in the 40s. It's a broad language that can be used in many different areas of mathematics. But also, you know, as of the past few decades, people realize it's a language that can express many things even outside of mathematics, in computer science, in theoretical physics, and in even in linguistics, they start using category theory. And so it's a very interesting, broad language. It's extremely flexible, so it's able to talk about all these different areas in one uniform language. And so that's fascinating.
Many scientific theories have already been categorified, so now Yanofsky can compare them if he can somehow measure the information content of these structures. To do this, he is using a tool from computer science called Kolmogorov complexity, which he is applying to categories. Kolmogorov complexity describes how much information is contained in a string of letters or numbers in terms of the computing resources needed to reproduce it.
This goes back to the 60s. People were giving these strings and describing how much information they have. Okay, now that's great for strings, but I'm not interested in strings. I'm interested in structures, mathematical structures, computer science structures, physics structures. And so I want to do the same thing for Kolmogorov complexity, but instead of on strings, I want to talk about it on categorical structures.
Yanofsky has created a programming language that he calls SAMI to generate these categorical structures. So the information content of each structure will be the length of the most succinct SAMI computer program that generates it. And comparing the results for different mathematical structures should give insights into why Occam's razor seems to work.
It's interesting, just as a unifying language, you have all these different things, physics, mathematics, computer science, and you're looking, you know, what's understandable, using this one measure to see how these things work.
For Yanofsky, this project is a bit of a comeback to research, as he's been more than a little occupied writing a popular science book that was published by MIT Press last year called The Outer Limits of Reason.
Over the past few years, I've been teaching these classes in theoretical computer science. In theoretical computer science, you ask questions. In regular computer science, you ask questions like, what can a computer do, and how do you get a computer to do this, and how do you get a robot to do that? And in theoretical computer science, you ask questions like, what can a computer not do, and what are the limitations of a computer, and what can a computer not do efficiently, and things like that. So I got into these questions of limitations of computers, and then beforehand I had written a book on quantum computing, which is something to do with quantum physics. And I realized there's a lot of limitations in quantum physics also. There's things that human beings cannot know in quantum physics. And I put all these things together in many other areas, and I just talked about limitations of knowledge. Mm. So the book is called The Outer Limits of Reason, what science, mathematics, and logic cannot tell us. And so it's all about these limitations of what human beings cannot go further in knowing.
Do you think by describing the periphery of what we can know, we can understand what we can know better?
Yes, right, that's one thing. And then also, once you know that there's something you can't know, you can stop looking for it, or you can you know, it's good to know the boundaries of what you know. Of course, you won't always know the boundaries of what you know, and that's why science is interesting, you're always looking and searching, yeah. Going further.
What kind of reaction have you had to it?
Well, the book is selling very well, and it's got very nice reviews. And really, I get a lot of emails and stuff like that from people who read the book and think it's very interesting.
Do you feel like you're a bit of an evangelist for the subject?
I love explaining things, and then students come over after and say, oh, that's, yeah, now I understand it. That's a great feeling.
Yeah.
This popular science book, it's very interesting. I took this book. I made a class to teach it. The class was called Paradoxes and the Limits of Knowledge. And I wrote chapters and I handed them out and they read it and they, you know, they complained. And anytime they found something too complicated, they, you know, wrote on the side, this is too complicated, make it easier, make it easier. Mm. And then I did it. And the book is extremely... I mean, one of the remarks I get a lot is, you know, this is an extremely readable book. And I really, there's like Gödel's incompleteness, which is a famous thing, Bell's theorem in physics. Yeah. And I really spend pages and pages trying to explain it.
Yeah.
As best I can.
And that's because you had all your editors, student editors, who
right,
were amazing.
Right. No, so there's nothing like a student who, you know, they get so excited catching me on a spelling mistake and laughing at my horrible grammar or whatever, and they, you know, circle it and underline it and come over to me after class, how could you write that? And I taught that one semester, another semester, the third, you know.
Yeah.
And after a couple of semesters, they stopped complaining, which means...
Your book was ready.
Your book was ready. Great way of writing a book, right? Yeah. Because there's nothing like, you know, students to... You don't want students to laugh at you behind your back. I wanted to have a complete book before I send it into publishers. So it took about 2 or 3 years.
With his FQXI grant, Yunovsky also hopes to use Kolmogorov complexity to think about easy problems and hard problems, which can be very difficult to tell apart.
Computer science, they want to know what's a hard problem, what's an easy problem.
Is that to know whether it's worth making
right.
code or something?
Or more important, whether it's worth to give up. So let's talk about the traveling salesman problem.
Yeah.
That's a typical problem. You know, a young person wants to go to 100 different cities, and he wants to do it in the shortest possible route.
Yeah.
So we know that that's considered an extremely hard problem,
yeah.
And that it would take trillions of centuries to do.
Yeah.
It's in the book, whatever. So one thing to do is give up finding the perfect solution, and then what you do is what's called an approximation algorithm. You try to approximate and find, you know, I don't want the best answer. I want about what's the best answer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helping to find what are hard problems is two things. One is to learn when to give up. And you give up finding the answer, and you just find an approximate answer.
Yeah.
And the other thing is as follows. Let's say you're working for a boss, and he tells you he wants to find the solution to this and this problem. And you go and you find that this is a very hard problem, and it can't be solved within trillions of centuries. You go over to your boss and you say, look, I can write a computer program to do this, but it'll take a trillion centuries for you to get the answer. Your boss is going to fire you.
Whereas your theory, you could actually quantify it.
Right, but with my theory, I can say, look, this program is going to take trillions of centuries, and I can prove to you that this is a hard problem. And you know what the boss is going to say? Well, he's not going to fire you because nobody else is going to be able to do a good job either.
Yeah.
Right. So you somehow, you know that this is a hard problem, therefore nothing's going to help, therefore we can move on.
Thank you to Noson Yunovsky for describing his FQXI-funded research to Sophie Hebden. If you visit the website www.fqxi.org/community, you can read more about his work and his books.
But now, the item that Puffy has been getting most excited about... Quantum pigeons.
Yes, we've covered some pretty bizarre quantum ideas over the years in this podcast, Brendan. But this new principle, proposed by FQXI members Yukir Aharonov and Jeff Tollickson and others, really has to be one of the weirdest. It turns out that when you measure quantum systems in a particular way, you can get some very odd results. One example is the quantum pigeonhole principle. Let's say you have 3 pigeons and 2 pigeonholes, and you have to place the pigeons in those pigeonholes. What do you think would happen?
Is Puffy allowed to eat any of the pigeons?
No.
Okay, well, in that case, at least one hole will contain two pigeons at the same time. There's no way around it. Three pigeons, two pigeon holes.
Well, it turns out that in the quantum world, things aren't quite that simple. In fact, you can put three quantum particles into two boxes and yet find that no two particles are in the same box. I spoke with Jeff Tollickson of Chapman University earlier, who told me about this very strange result and how it describes a new kind of correlation between quantum particles that's even spookier than usual.
Let me start off by just reminding everybody what the classical pigeonhole principle, which goes back a long time to actually Pierre Schley, the mathematician. Suppose you have two boxes or two pigeonholes, and you have three pigeons, and all the pigeons are in the two boxes, then it's a general theorem that it must be the case that in one of those boxes there will be at least two or more pigeons together at the same time.
Right, it hardly seems like you need a theorem for that. It just seems common sense.
Completely common sense and obvious, and it could never possibly be wrong, right?
Right.
Well, so,
except.
So it turns out in quantum mechanics it is wrong in the following sense, that, again, if you consider the simplest case in which we have three pigeons, or in our case we translate that into three particles that we can do, you know, precision measurements on in actual laboratories. Pigeons are difficult to deal with in the laboratory. So, so in this case, we start our three particles far away from each other, and we prepare them in some state of spin. Say, spin in the x direction is up. And it's important just to sort of emphasize the point that, you know, these three particles are very far separated from each other. We know experimentally how to prepare a situation so that there is no entanglement whatsoever.
Let's just talk for a second about entanglements, where you can take, you know, two or more particles, and if you prepare them together in a certain way, then their properties become kind of intertwined, so that no matter how far apart you take them, when you carry out a measurement on one, the influence of that measurement has an effect on its partner as well.
That's right. But that's the preparation or the preselection. There is no entanglement.
The preselection is what we usually talk about when we do any experiment at all. It's just we want to do an experiment on some stuff, and so we prepare it, and that's the preselection. You know, we prepare what kind of things we want to put into the experiment, and then we conduct the experiment. And in some sense, that's where most scientific experiments then just stop. We've performed it, and then we look at the result. And with post-selection, that's sort of an additional step that kind of takes place after the experiment has been conducted, where you kind of choose which of the results you're going to analyze in more detail based on some criteria.
Right. And the post-preparation or post-selection is, you could do almost anything, frankly, but to make it simple, we chose spin up in the y direction. And let me emphasize again that in that post-selection measurement, again, the three particles are far apart from each other, and there is no entanglement in that post-selection measurement. Another way of thinking about that is you could say that, well, the particles, they don't know about each other.
And for some reason, depending on the choice of which particular sort of output materials you decide to analyze in detail, based on that sort of later action, that can have an effect on what actually happened during the experiment that was carried out in between.
That's right. I mean, the absolutely extraordinary thing is that we showed that they have correlations which are stronger than classical, which is the kind of thing that we thought you would need entanglement, either in the initial or in the final state, to be able to create or to manifest. And so we discovered that when you take the very step of even including a post-selection, then there are fundamental new aspects to the whole question of what is an interaction and what is a correlation. And so with this pre-selection and that post-selection, we can arrange that no two of those three particles are ever together in the same box, even though all three particles are, in fact, in those two boxes. And translating to pigeons, that means, you know, no two pigeon is together in the same box, even though all three pigeons are indeed in those two boxes. And then this scales up to arbitrary number of particles. You could have huge numbers of particles all crammed into those two boxes. Nevertheless, no two of those particles are ever together in the same box.
Right, okay. I don't know why I'm saying okay, because it's again, something that just, you know, it's just making my brain melt a little bit. So you could have an infinite number of pigeons and squeeze them into three boxes, but at no time would there be more than one pigeon in any of these boxes. Your pigeons have gone missing somewhere. Where have they gone? You know, where are the pigeons, Jeff? Where are they?
The right way to say it is that no two of them are ever together. So say you label them pigeon one, pigeon two, and pigeon three. So you can simultaneously measure whether pigeon one and pigeon two are together. The answer is no, they're never together. And at the same time, if we weekly measure whether pigeon two and pigeon three are together, the answer is no, those two pigeons are never together. And also simultaneously, at the same time, we measure whether or not pigeon one and pigeon three, so that's all possible combinations of two pigeons, we see the answer is also no.
Okay, so there's something tricky happening here with the way that we're phrasing this, I guess. You can't ever identify a pair of pigeons that are in the same box, even if you run through every possible combination of pairs of pigeons.
And yes, in some sense that's true, because this new aspect of correlations and the nature of interaction, it does require you to ask these sort of joint questions. Are any two particles ever together? And the answer is no. Now, if you were to just simply ask, where is an individual pigeon, if you were to strongly ask that question, namely, you open the box and said, okay, you know, which pigeon is there, then you would see exactly what you would expect if there is no correlation whatsoever between these pigeons. You would see half the time the pigeons are in the left box, and the other half the time the pigeons are in the right box, which is exactly what you would expect from the way the state was prepared. It's a 50-50 combination, and it's also exactly what you would expect if there was no correlations between them whatsoever.
Now, I'm going to say something which I'm pretty sure is wrong, but you're going to have to sort of explain to me why it's the wrong way of thinking, because I'm going to give you a very crude interpretation, which isn't even sort of thinking about quantum mechanics at all, but it's thinking about the classical sense. In terms of asking this question, you know, in the very clever way that you have about trying to think about two pigeons at the same time, you know, couldn't it just be that, you know, if I first of all, I have three pigeons, and I ask, are pigeon one and pigeon two in the same box? And I get the answer, no. And then I ask, are pigeon two and pigeon three in the same box? And I get the answer, no. And then I ask, are pigeon one and pigeon three in the same box? And I get the answer, no. Could it just be that the pigeons are flying about between the boxes so that, you know, every time I ask the question, you know, they've kind of settled into this pattern where the particular two that I'm interested in are in different boxes. But by the time I've formulated, you know, the next question, they've just moved.
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of designing experiments such that interpretation would not be a plausible interpretation. The basic setup, three electrons, say, now we're just measuring the electrostatic interaction between them, and we see that they have no idea that there's any other electron next to them. There's no electrostatic repulsion of the electron. I mean, just to give a sort of a naive example, in this case, the electrons would have to be doing some kind of faster-than-light transfer, and they're doing this even though there's no forces that are introduced here that would cause them to zip back and forth, you know, and so on and so forth.
So where are these correlations coming from? I mean, is everything just correlated with everything else? Pigeons or cats or people or electrons or photons or just anything and everything?
Well, I mean, that's certainly not the way we're taught to think about physics. in some sense, locality or the separability of the universe in general seems to be a sacred principle. And it is indeed, you're right, extremely mysterious and actually very profound. You know, as Monty Python would put it, and now for something completely different.
Are there any practical applications of this?
Yes.
For hiding pigeons, perhaps.
For overpopulation of pigeons, for example.
Yes, or to save the housing situation. You could have an infinite number of people living in two houses.
The house, absolutely. All such applications like that. Well, I had the pleasure of sitting in on Richard Feynman's class just right after he published this famous paper, which was one of the critical things that led to the whole quantum information sort of paradigm shift. And little did people know that this thing that was in the esoteric regions of foundations of physics, namely entanglement and all the things that people were trying to do to verify it experimentally, little did people know that there would be so many applications. And people even argued that this was the source of the power of all these new quantum computing and so on and so forth. Well, the physics behind the quantum pigeonhole effect, we believe, will have many such applications as well. I mean, this is a ubiquitous aspect of nature. But we expect that something similar will happen here.
That was Jeff Tollickson, Melting Our Brains. You can read more about his work on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
And, in honor of Puffy, Jeff actually told me about another experiment that was recently carried out based on some of these ideas, called the Quantum Cheshire Cat Experiment.
This is going to make my head hurt even more, isn't it?
I think it really might. This experiment was published in Nature Communications, and it harks back to the wonderful image in Alice in Wonderland, in which Alice meets a grinning cat, who eventually disappears, leaving only his grin behind.
Surely they haven't carried out this experiment using cats.
No, they have not. But they have managed to separate a neutron from one of its properties so that the mass of the neutron travelled in one direction, while one of its properties, its magnetic moment, travelled in another. You can hear more about that experiment in an extended interview with Jeff Tollickson on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Suddenly it all makes sense. This is why Puffy never grins. He's been involved in some kind of quantum experiment that has separated his sense of humor from the rest of him.
Of course, we must stress that no animals were harmed during the making of this podcast.
So thank you once again to Andrew Jordan, Carlo Ravelli, Nosin Yanofsky, Sophie Hebden, and Jeff Tollickson. If you want to contact us, then as always, you can reach us on Twitter at FQXI or email us at podcast@fqxi.org.
He's been Brendan Foster.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Puffy the Cat.
I still don't get it. Where did those pigeons go?